Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Joining me today is Felix Ruiz de la Orden, who is the chief steward of the Teaching Support Staff Union here at SFU. The Teaching Support Staff Union has recently held a strike vote, getting 94% support from its members. Welcome to the show, Felix.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So the TSSU has been... let's first off talk about who do you represent at the TSSU, because it's a pretty significant part of the university setup here.
Yeah, so our membership consists of most of the precarious and non-faculty teaching and research staff at Simon Fraser University. Our members conduct the majority of research and teaching at the university, but are often in the most precarious kind of positions with their work.
So people who aren't familiar with how universities operate these days might not be aware that the sort of stereotypical professor that everyone thinks of when they think of universities, they only represent a portion of teaching that goes on at universities. Maybe you can explain just a bit more about that.
Yeah, so the way that it's set up is, for example, a lot of lectures are to about 300 students, especially in the kind of, if you're a first year or a second year undergrad, you're going to lecture halls with oftentimes up to 300 students. But to kind of facilitate discussion and more engagement from the students, those big lecture halls, those 300 students are divided into what's called tutorials, and those tutorials is where a lot of the kind of hands-on teaching happens, and those tutorials are run by what are called teaching assistants. So those teaching assistants are our members we represent. Or members that are part of the TSSU. And additionally, there's been a move away from kind of faculty members to what's called sessional instructors at the university too. So sessional instructors run an entire course, much like a professor would, but they are essentially... they have to renew their contract every semester. So they're much more precarious. They don't have as much job security as a faculty member, and they make significantly less money as well.
Yeah, they're basically getting sort of essentially hired on a course-by-course basis.
Yeah, precisely.
And every semester is a new deal.
Yeah.
So I guess the contract... that the union has with the university for its members is coming up, and you've been in negotiation for a while. What are some of the key issues that remain unresolved between the TSSU and SFU?
Yeah, so our collective agreement actually expired last April in 2022, and... we've been bargaining for that new contract since November of last year. And when we got to the bargaining table, we came to realize that as the employer, Simon Fraser University, essentially wants to cut up our collective agreement. So they want us to take lots of concessions around kind of priority rights, seniority rights, and rights to promotions. So, for example, sessionals have seniority rights. Sessional instructors have seniority rights. And so if you have seniority, you can actually, you have some sort of job security. Once for sessionals as well, once you reach kind of a certain threshold of teaching consecutively, you can actually get promoted to a faculty temporary faculty position. SFU wants to just basically take this away, get this out of our collective agreement, and they also want to get rid of priority rights for teaching assistants that guarantees positions for graduate students who need the funding. So those are some of the things that we're actually fighting against, and we don't want SFU to take away. We're also fighting for a cost of living adjustment for our members, including funding packages for graduate students that are a minimum of $32,000 a year after tuition deductions. And that's basically just to make ends meet in the Lower Mainland when inflation is at record high and housing prices are astronomical.
What's the current level of funding for that?
It varies by department to department, but on average, it comes around less than $20,000 a year. And there's these really kind of exploitative practices as well throughout the university, where, say, for example, you get an offer for $20,000 a year. So you're a graduate student, you've applied to school. You get a funding offer that says, here, we'll give you $20,000 a year to attend our school. That $20,000 a year is almost always attached to work. So you'll get that $20,000, but you have to work, for example, two teaching assistant jobs throughout the course of that year, or you'd have to work kind of a research assistant job out of the course of that year. There are kind of situations in certain departments that if you take another job within or find another source of funding, even if you take another job, then they'll pull funding from elsewhere. So that $20,000 ends up being kind of a cap of funding, a cap of money that you can make, no matter how much you're working. And what's been happening is that a lot of students are having to take jobs off campus. A lot of students are having to kind of stretch themselves out really thin just to make ends meet. We're also primarily do a lot of the teaching on Burnaby Mountain, which is kind of secluded from a lot of other places. So it's also really difficult to get jobs, you know, off campus, yeah, where you're having to do kind of all that travel as well.
So so you've been negotiating for a while, and what sort of finally pushed you to move towards a strike vote?
The concessions, for sure. Our experience historically with this university is that they do not budge. They do not kind of want to bargain. They delay. They're completely unserious. And they're unserious until we put pressure on them.
Right.
So we weren't getting anywhere at the bargaining table. We reached an impasse, so both their proposals were on the table, and there was a disagreement. There are only a couple of options for us at that point. Either we can kind of put pressure through rallies and stuff, which hasn't been working, or we can go on strike. So we started hearing from membership that they wanted to go on strike because of these issues. We held a general membership meeting, and the membership decided to vote on to take a strike vote and say, look, we're tired of this. let's cancel our bargaining sessions in April. They're not getting us anywhere, and let's hold a strike vote. So at that meeting, we actually got a unanimous yes to hold that strike vote. Over 100 members were present, and so we went to work to take this strike vote as well. We got to talk to more members across all three campuses in Surrey, Vancouver, and Burnaby. And that's, like you mentioned earlier, we ended up getting a 94% mandate to go on strike. So people are upset, and they want to see something done about it.
So that's a pretty solid mandate. So what happens now? And I guess for students who might be listening, wondering about their semester, this doesn't necessarily mean you're going to go on strike right away. So, but what happens now?
Yeah, so it definitely does not mean that we're going to go on strike right away. SFU has kind of responded with a couple of legal mechanisms that they can use, one of them being to take us to mediation. We're in mediation now. To determine whether or not we can get a deal done. We can't take any sort of job action until that mediation process is complete.
Just very briefly, how does mediation change the process from what you were doing before?
So essentially mediation is you speak to a mediator at the labor board, and they're talking to both sides, and they're trying to come up with a compromise for this contract.
And if that doesn't work out, then what happens?
If that doesn't work out, then as the union would have to kind of decide on what the next steps are.
Right.
All indications would be that we'd be taking some sort of job action.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously you don't want to give up your strategy, but yeah. that can mean a lot of different things from picketing to... A lot of different things.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sometimes can be a common misconception, is that strikes are the job actions, I should say, are just, you know, picket lines. There's a kind of a variety of ways that we can interrupt or withhold our labor, and that is disruptive. So I'm sure everyone's kind of heard of grade withholding, which has been super effective for us in the past. I'm not going to say that's a strategy or anything that we've decided on, but that's something that happened in the past. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it looks like there's still a lot to go in this process.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming in today and telling me about it.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate that. Felix Ruiz de la Orden is the chief steward and organizer for the Teaching Support Staff Union here at SFU. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much.
This is Bird Note. The Santa Marta saberwing is a hummingbird species so rare, they've only been documented twice in recent years. Native to the mountains of Colombia, they're part of the hummingbird group called emeralds for their luminous green feathers. Officially described in 1946, no one reported another sighting until 2010. Then the saberwing went missing for years. They became one of more than 150 bird species considered lost. Not yet extinct, but missing, eluding every attempt to find them. Then, in 2022, a researcher named Jürgen Vega was studying the birds of a mountain range called the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta. He spotted an unusual, large hummingbird. The bird stuck around long enough for a photo, and the Santa Marta saberwing was lost no more. This bird was a male with a vibrant blue throat. In previous centuries, the species was probably common, but most of the forests where they live have been destroyed or fragmented, leading to declines in this species and many others. Biologists are now trying to understand the size and location of the saberwing's remaining populations. Learn more about lost birds and efforts to find them on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Rimmel.
Do you like music, or do you like technology, or do you like talking to people? CJSF Radio is the place for you. Here at CJSF, the opportunities are endless. You can interview artists and bands, speak up for what you believe in, or even host your own show, and tons more. To find out more information, visit cjsf.ca.
What it would be like to keep bees in your backyard, or brew your own beer, or wondered how the heck a 3D printer actually works? Curiosity killed the cat, the saying goes, but we wonder anyways. Humans are inquisitive by nature. How can we find the answers to these questions? The good old YouTube spiral. Start out searching for brewing tutorials and end up learning how to code, all in an afternoon. I've spent countless hours online researching and troubleshooting. My curiosity led me to a diverse community of makers and creatives right in my own backyard. Vancouver is witnessing a sharp rise in DIY, or do-it-yourself, culture. More and more people are turning to their peers and sort of crowdsourcing knowledge to deepen their understanding of the natural world, empower themselves with new skills, and reconnect to their local communities. I spoke with five DIYers about what it is they're up to and what makes them tick. Along the way, I was hoping to discover why the DIY movement is on such a rise. Meet Aaron Udall, an environmental educator running the beekeeping programs for the Environmental Youth Alliance. With a background in conservation biology, Aaron specializes in creating programs that inspire youth to become curious about their own backyards and encourage environmental stewardship.
I was in university and I really didn't have any sort of knowledge or connection to bees. And I got a summer internship. And in the interview, the professor opened up a box of bees and I was just totally hooked. The different species will blow your mind. There's different colors you've never even imagined, sizes, body shapes. And then when you go out in the field and you see these organisms in action and all the different species interacting with different kinds of flowers, you realize the intricacy of those symbiotic relationships. You could study your whole life and not know a fraction of what there is to know about bees.
Ethnobotanist Bryce Watts is a lover of plants. He's a founding member of Forager Foundation, a local organization committed to promoting global cultural heritage. He leads public foraging tours in and around Vancouver, educating people on the wild foods that can be found locally.
It started from my grandpa on my mom's side. I was really young when he would take us out into the forest. He lived in rural Alberta, and so he would always point out little berries or little leaves. And it was great when you're a little kid, you're just running through the forest and you get to nibble on some berries every so often. Didn't really pay any attention to it, though, or didn't realize that it had an impact on me. And then I ended up working in a greenhouse company just out of high school and found out, okay, I love plants. And then, actually, it was pretty much just a year ago that I remembered my grandpa taking us into the forest, and it kind of clicked, okay, that's where the love started. It's generations that have built upon generations for knowing what you can use and what's something to stay away from, and so it's definitely working off of the people that have come before us.
Ben Coley's love affair with Belgian beer began roughly a decade ago, after a fateful trip to Antwerp. Building up his knowledge through a combination of brewing school, beer sabbaticals to Belgium, and persistent home brewing, Ben opened up Doggerod Brewing in Burnaby in 2014.
Homebrewing at first was a friend of mine had the idea. It sounded like drinking a lot of beer in the backyard, which I was, you know, into. So there were four of us making these little like 20-liter batches of beer. I think we drank more beer while we were brewing than we actually made at first. Gradually, my homebrewing crew of four of us whittled down to three of us, and then two of us, and then me alone. And basically, I was just the nerdiest one. At first, I just, you know, was super excited to just be able to make beer. That just seemed like a magical thing to be able to do that. And then I just kind of went down the rabbit hole, internet research, buying books to figure out how to do it better, how to, you know, really figure out the processes and get everything nailed down so that I could get that exact flavor that I wanted. And then eventually, you know, I'd broken at this point two full carboys full of beer in my house. And my wife finally just said, you need to get a real brewery. You can't do this here anymore.
Excited by the creative possibilities that tools like 3D printers, laser cutters, and CNC routers offered, artist Julie Van Ooyen became a fabricator at Maker Labs in Vancouver's East Side. The collective makerspace boasts 26,000 square feet of workshops, communal tools, and storefront, and offers classes to the public on the various tools and technologies available for use at the space.
I was a part-time student at Emily Carr, and and I was really interested in kind of getting more into the art and design and fabrication world. I got involved with Maker Labs about a year ago. I was hired as a fabricator, so I primarily create custom fabrication projects for people using the tools that we have, which include 3D printers, laser cutters, a full wood shop, CNC routers, and I also teach classes on those same tools for people who are interested in using them on their own to create their own custom projects.
An avid traveler and son of a polyglot who speaks 16 languages, Mark Kaufman is the co-founder of Link, a web and app language learning platform. Passionate about autonomous education, Mark and his team have been developing a language learning system that breaks down common barriers for adult learners.
I had played pro hockey for 10 years, so I had been playing in different countries. And first year I played overseas, I played in Italy, and I still remember the feeling of arriving there and, okay, like, I don't know any Italian. And was a little bit surprised that pretty much no one spoke English in our little town. That's when you realize, yeah, you know what? I'm spending, you know, 6 months there, and you're playing a hockey team with local guys, and they're joking around, and you can ask people for translations, but it's not the same. You don't get the same out of it, out of the experience, if you can't start to understand and speak with them in their own language.
In speaking with each of these DIYers, I noticed that they shared a common curiosity about the world and how it works, something that compelled them to do the things they do. We love exploring and discovering new things. It's human nature. It's this curiosity that makes us innovators and creative problem solvers. An educational shift is taking place as a result of more and more people embracing their curious nature. A lot of learning is now taking place outside traditional classrooms, focused on immersing people in an experience, learning by doing. This hands-on approach is something Erin from the Environmental Youth Alliance is deeply passionate about. I caught up with her on a warm spring day at the EYA's Honey House in Strathcona Community Garden to find out what her program participants and the bees get up to.
Maybe could you describe what we're looking at?
Yeah, so this is a frame of what had honey on it last year and now is empty because we removed all the honey. And it is wax comb that just has little entrails of honey all over it. It's very sticky on my fingers and made of wood. The other essential thing that you need as a beekeeper is a smoker. Try to use the smoker as least amount as possible, but it kind of is just this kind of old looking contraption where you put in some old cloth or something into the bottom of it, get the lid on tight, and you light a fire in this thing, and then you blow smoke into the hives, and it just stops their receptors in their antenna from picking up different signals that if they did want to go after you for whatever reason, then it confuses them a little bit.
What's in the top there?
We just have put grass in the top to prevent, or just kind of blocks the smoke when we put it away the last time, so that no fire is going to get out. So this is bits of wax that we save off of the hive. This dark stuff smells very earthy. Kind of, it's probably been smoked a number of times. The bees have reused this wax over and over again to put honey in, to lay their eggs. And so it has, yeah, quite an earthy tone to it.
Passionate about youth education, Erin shared with me the experience of young participants that enter the beekeeping program each year.
The general attitude of youth coming into our programs is they're excited and they're also nervous. They don't know what to expect. How they're taught from adults is, you know, you're limited in certain ways. Like, you can do this up to a point. And we are, like, trusting them and giving them access to bees, which is a pretty intimate experience. And it can be a scary experience. So we spend a lot of time talking about that before, of course, we let them go in there. But yeah, they're really excited and curious and nervous. So we deal with that nervousness in a very direct way by talking about getting stung by bees, what that feels like, what is the role of bees in our ecosystem, lots of things like that before we go into the hive and we build up a level of respect for these organisms. Our tagline is helping youth discover their inner nature.